Today's Teisho is on case 87 in the Blue Cliff Record, the Blue Rock Collection, the PN Lu. Case 87 is entitled Umon's Medicine and Sickness Cure Each Other. Ango's Introduction. The clear-eyed person knows no restriction. At one time, he stands on the top of the mountain, with the weeds thick around him. At another time, he is in the bustle of the marketplace, enjoying perfect ease of mind. When he displays the wrath of Nada, he is three-faced and six-armed. When he shows the mercy of the sun-faced and moon-faced, he gives forth the all-embracing life of blessing. In every particle, he reveals all the bodies of the Buddha. Mixing with people, he trudges through the mire. When he performs a transcendent action, even Buddhas cannot follow him, and they are driven back thousands of miles. Is there anyone among you who can go with him and act with him? See the following. Umon said to his disciples, medicine and sickness cure each other. All earth is medicine. Where do you find yourself? All the earth is medicine. Where do you find yourself? Secho's verse, all the earth is medicine, ancient and modern. People make a great mistake. Shut the gate, but do not build the cart. The universe is the highway, vast and wide. Mistaken, all is mistaken. Though their noses are stuck up to heaven, they will still be pierced for a rope. So, this is our, for those of you who arrived on Tuesday, this is the fourth day of Sesshin. And I want to thank everybody for making a wonderful effort in the Zendo this morning. Everybody here is practicing wholeheartedly. And for those of you who are new to the Sesshin process, you know, I think that everybody was impressed by the change that happened on day three. You know, sometime around the middle of day three, people, it's like the air has changed today from sweltering and hot to cool and refreshing. It's so beautiful that just happened overnight. It was actually 70 degrees this morning. So after being, you know, in the mid to high 90s, you know, 70 degrees is like beautiful and refreshing. So I think that people on day three of Sesshin, especially their first Sesshin, may feel that cool breeze, right, that coolness. And then, you know, maybe last night or today you find not the same, you know, it's not the same. I can remember, you know, when I started doing Zen practice, I had a lot of trouble physically with sitting. So it just seemed like my body was not well made for meditation. And I could never quite get the right posture. You know, I would try cushions under my left leg, and that didn't, you know, that worked for a while, and then cushions under my right leg, and that worked for a while. And then I'd find an arrangement that worked for a few months, and then something else would bother me. My hip would start to bother me, you know. So I had a fair amount of discomfort when I was doing Zen at the beginning. And I remember we had a Sesshin, a meditation retreat, out in a place called Moses Lake, Washington. Our Sangha did not really have its own sesshin facility. So we used to rent different places in the greater Seattle area. And we rented a place in the eastern part of the state, which is more like New Mexico. And they retreat center there that we rented, and we stayed in these cabins. And I remember that sesshin. I had a lot of pain at first, and then around day three, it was like the evening of day three, I can still remember, all of a sudden, it was like the pain just completely disappeared. It was like somebody had hit a switch and the pain was no longer bothering me, and I felt totally liberated. And when it was my turn to go to Dokusan, I went in and I saw a Genki Roshi, and I said, "Genki Roshi, I'm sitting and I have no pain." And I said, "You know, I am never going to feel pain again." And he laughed, right? Because the next day, of course, I was in pain again. So it's not quite the case that go through 3 days of sesshin and then all is resolved, but it's definitely the case that you go through 3 days of sesshin and you have a glimpse of something. You have a glimpse of liberation. It's like the cool breeze comes and blows in your face for a while, and you realize, oh, so life could be like this. And then, the next day, lots of things complicate this situation. You're tired. You've been sitting for 3.5 days now. And also, people will report that their minds are not as focused, right? A lot of mental chatter comes back. So people will come into the Dokusan room and say, I don't know, I'm just having a lot of thoughts again, right? And so that's part of the process too. It's like a little bit like every day you have to climb back up the mountaintop. It doesn't stay this way, it's not as your first sesshin is in many ways the most difficult sesshin you'll ever do. If you practice regularly, sesshins gradually become at first more manageable, and then really positive, really wonderful. But it takes time. It would be unrealistic to expect that in 3 days a person's complete somatic reality would be transformed. That would be something indeed, right? But we have a lot to work through. Most of us have mental habits that are really deeply ingrained. Some of them go back to the time we were like little children. So some of our mental habits go back to a time we can't even remember because it was so, is it pre-linguistic, right? So this is definitely part of what we're struggling with. These mental habits affect our responses to things on it almost feels like an instinctive level. So these are deep responses, and also, the body is a mind-body system. It's in the Lankavatara Sutra, the major sutra for the Zen school, it talks about energy systems. And the body is a kind of an energy system, and it has energy habits. And those have a psychological dimension and they have a somatic dimension. So, you know, how we distribute the energy in our body is also affected by our past. So, you know, my brother, for example, had we had a father who was a very stern disciplinarian, actually frightened us a lot. My brother and I always had, he's no longer alive. But a lot of, problems with upset stomach, like easily upset stomach. When my brother would get tense, the first thing that would bother him is his stomach. And that would be true for me too, his digestive system. I remember when we were kids, we had to go to. We went to a school near Baltimore, and my brother had this terrible teacher who really frightened him. I remember he would, he'd be getting ready to go to school, and he would actually throw up, you know. The teacher was such a terrible teacher. My mother went down to the school and had my brother moved to another teacher. And there was this wonderful woman whose name I still remember, Mrs. Funkhauser. And Mrs. Funkhauser was a true teacher. She wanted to mentor and liberate her students. And she brought my brother out of the darkness into a very wonderful place. We were so lucky she existed. Such people are bodhisattvas in the world. Those experiences of being under threat, or being perhaps subject to physical violence, and then colors how you respond to emotional violence or cruelty, and that has a somatic dimension. It gets laid down in the energy habits of our body. So, a lot of meditation practice is like undoing, it's like going through the layers of our mind, and at every layer there's like obstacles that have to be worked through. So, some people there are many different kinds of people come to Sesshin, there was one woman who came long ago, and basically had a habit of resisting anything she saw as authority. She must have had a very domineering childhood. Her parents dominated her, so she would when we would eat in the dining hall, Zen style, we'd get served and then we eat rather quickly. Some people come here and they can't believe how quickly we eat, She really resented that, and she would, the more quickly we ate, the slower she would eat. So everybody would be done and she would have like full bowls. So finally I asked her, I said, listen, would you like to eat by yourself? At first she was reluctant to do that. She said, why do you eat so quickly? And I said, well, that's the style. I don't know why. We're eating this food to keep our bodies and minds in good health so we can get back to the cushion. And I remember one time when it was time to put up all the bowl, you rinse your bowls, but you wipe your balls with the pickle, you clean them, you wipe them with your cloth, and you stack them up. I remember one time she still had food in her balls, and she stacked them up with the food still in it, right? Like, basically, screw you, you know. So, you know, she made this into an issue, right? Because she brought this baggage with her, right? And unfortunately, you know, there was no way to work around this. You know, I said you can eat by yourself, and that was a problem. So, you know, this was a set of obstacles that she brought to the experience of sesshin that didn't allow her to you know, basically change, right? I think she stayed through the sesshin, but she never came back, and she was, you know, angry about the experience. But I have the feeling that wasn't the first time she had been through this process, right? I have the feeling that she had been through other situations like this. In fact, I may be misremembering, but there was a Chinese restaurant in Highland Park, and I think she tried to state they were serving fish or something, and she tried to serve it, start a demonstration in the restaurant or something. And at any rate, she created a scene, and so this is sort of like a pattern in her life, and she wasn't able to benefit from this process. There are subtler patterns, right? Subtler patterns. You know, basically, when I was studying with Genki Roshi, growing up, I was sort of a nerd, right? And I lived some of my life in Baltimore, which was a really tough town. It probably still is, you know. I lived in a nice neighborhood, if you know Baltimore, Lockraven Boulevard area. But, you know, I always used to worry about getting beaten up on the way to school, and the older kids would really, you know, beat you up just for their amusement and shake you down and do, you know, like literally like take your lunch money and stuff. So, you know, I learned to be avoidant, you know, in lots of different ways. And I learned that I was never going to be, physically powerful, but I learned I could be good at school, you know. So I became a really good student. And when I started doing Zen with Genki Roshi, you know, I brought some of these attitudes, not consciously, but unconsciously, to the process, you know. So for a long time, I would come into Dokusan, and I really couldn't communicate with Genki. You know, and as I mentioned yesterday, when I was working with the breath perception koan, I kept trying to give him a smart answer. I tried to be a good student. So I thought, you know, I can show him how intelligent I am, not consciously, but I tried to do with Genki Roshi what I had done with my teachers, right? So, you know, when I was in school, in the 10th grade, we all had to read Brave New World and write a paper about it. And I wrote a paper, and my teacher actually said, this actually happened to me. She actually said, somebody in this class has written a wonderful paper. Right? And she said, and it's Kurt Spellmeyer. And she said, the insight in this, it was like, oh, you know, I knew what I was going to do for a living, right? I was going to be an English teacher, right? You know, so what I wanted to write a paper for Genki Roshi, right, that would elicit that kind of response, right? I thought, you know, so I thought if I say something really pithy or intelligent or articulate, you know, he'll say, I did Dokusan today, and one person, his answer was very cogent. And I didn't necessarily want the public praise, but I wanted his praise, right? And so, you know, I tried writing poetry. I wrote a couple poems. I would write like haiku. And what I really was supposed to be doing was watching the breath and becoming one with the breath, right? But I didn't know how to do that. That hadn't gotten me any strokes, you know, as they used to say. So I did what I thought was going to get me a reward. And I didn't think about it consciously. I just behaved this way. You know, and later, eventually, I didn't ever really pass the breath perception koan. He never said, okay. He asked me to be the cook, and I was the cook for 6 months, and I threw myself into being the cook. And I did such a great job that he called me into Dokusan after a sashin, and he said, you know, you have really thrown yourself into cooking, and you've done such a, you've taken care of the whole sangha. So I'm going to let you start the mu koan, even though you know, you haven't really answered the breath perception koan yet. Later, when we were working with koans, Genki actually said to me once, he said, you know, you never share with me. And I thought that was fascinating. I mean, that was like, what? You know, but it was so true, right? I never shared with Genki Roshi. You know, I was like, it was like in therapy where you say, I think my wife and I don't get along because I'm a socialist and she's a liberal. You know, I wouldn't come in and say, I'm really, you know, I don't know what to do with this koan. I feel totally blocked, you know. I didn't want to be vulnerable in that way. Again, I didn't think, how not to be vulnerable. Let me see. But I just had developed these habits growing up in a dangerous environment of being very guarded about my feelings and being very uncommunicative, right? When in doubt, say nothing. Maybe you won't get beaten up, right? So, I brought this to the Zen practice. And, you know, it took me a long time to sort of work through my habits, and some of those habits were, you know, basically psychological habits, and some of them were like somatic habits too, right? You know, I have pretty decent posture now, I think, some of the time. But when I started doing Zen practice, I used to be hunched over very much, you know. So when I would get into pain, I would hunch over. And I would be leaning very far forward. In fact, the more I was in pain, the more I would hunch over. You know, Genki Roshi was a very sensitive and intelligent person. And he started out by saying, he would come by and say, straighten the back, straighten the back. And he'd straighten me up, and then like, you know, 15 minutes later, I'd be hunched over. And he tried that a couple times, and then he just let me sit that way, right? And gradually, my posture got a little better. I began to straighten up, you know. And I think it's part of a process. I think, you know, when I was in pain, I would get into like a defensive crouch, right? You know, I would bend over and forward, and it's like trying to ward off the attack or something like that. That's like a habit, you know, like a deeply ingrained psychosomatic habit. And straightening the back is actually a better response to being in pain. But it also opens you up, right? When you straighten your back, you're exposing your body in a way that makes you vulnerable. You know, all your organs are now exposed, right? This sounds a little nuts, but there's definitely a psychosomatic dimension to meditation practice. And we bring our karma in our body and in our mind and in the parts of the mind we aren't aware of, right? In our basic responses to things. So, you know, by karma, I don't mean, in popular speech, karma is understood to be like what goes around comes around, right? So if I do something bad to somebody later on, if I kick somebody in the butt, later on somebody will kick me in the butt, right? With interest, let's say. So I say, oh, that's karma, right? But that's not really what Buddhism means by karma. You know, what Buddhism means by karma is your psychosomatic history, right? You know, in other words, things leave a residue. When I was, things leave a residue, you know. So when I was living in Baltimore, you know, I used to go to school every day worried that somebody was going to physically assault me. And when I was in school, I would be hanging out with my friends, Mark Miller and a few of my other friends, and we would hang out together for protection, basically, out on the playground. And then, you know, so that had an effect, that had a long-lasting effect on my personality, right? You know, one time, my wife and I were in the kitchen, and she was reaching for something up in the cupboard, but she basically swung her right arm and I ducked like she was going to, you know, sock me in the mouth, you know. And she was shocked, like, what are you ducking for? But, you know, she's not even from Baltimore. But, you know, so a lot of what we're doing you could think of as therapy. Right, and there's a kind of there's a therapeutic dimension to Zen, and it's a whole body therapy, right? So it's not just sitting in a chair and talking; it's sitting on a mat, and basically we're realigning the body's energies, among other things. So, you know, actually, people have done lots of studies of people meditating on a mat. And, you know, your brain waves perform differently, and even your endocrine system performs differently. The distribution of energy in the body changes. So there's definitely a psychosomatic and therapeutic dimension to doing this. Even though it's difficult, it's not so different from some other therapies that involve the body, right? Even yoga, right? Yoga involves some discomfort, right? In yoga, you know, basically you work to the limits of your flexibility, and then you go a little bit beyond your flexibility. And in that way, you become more flexible. And over time, it has a big impact on the way the body organizes itself. And Zazen is somewhat different from yoga. It's also an asana. It's the highest asana. But it's it has a similar body-mind process. You know, so when you immobilize the body in this way, you definitely push consciousness into an altered state. And people become suddenly, you could say, like inner directed or something like that. And even the lotus posture, where you put some pressure on your thighs, has a rather profound impact on the character of your consciousness. You know, I remember reading, there's a woman named Temple Grandin who is autistic. And she was a very high functioning person. So even though she was autistic, she was able to go to school. She was able to learn and become, I believe she's a veterinarian. But she struggled mightily with her autism, which has many qualities, including somatic elements. And, you know, when she would get overstimulated, she would be unable to function. So it was easy for her to get overstimulated, and she would be like psychologically paralyzed by too much stimulation. So she actually built a machine where it was like a little exercise machine. But what she could do is stick her head into like something that would hold her head and shoulders still, and she would insert her upper body into this device. You know, she'd be on her all fours, and she'd insert herself into this device. It would lock her in and immobilize her upper body, and she would instantly grow calm. And later she developed a device like this for cattle to calm them down. You know, there's a lot we don't understand about the body, but this is definitely a therapeutic modality, right? And it's not just a therapeutic modality, but it has a dimension. I mean, if you're going to, you know, the Dalai Lama once said that the purpose of Buddhism is to basically the complete transformation of the human being. That's what he said. And I believe that's a good description of what Buddhism is trying to do. You know, the average person is not, quote unquote, enlightened. The average person's baseline consciousness isn't compassion, openness, and so on and so on. You do meet people who are quite exceptional in those ways, and some of them have never done Zazen and have never heard of Buddhism. Nevertheless, you know, Buddhism is like a program for producing such people. And so, even sitting on the cushion, hard as it is, has a long lasting and transformative effect. You know, the Dalai Lama has spent, the Dalai Lama until recently, I don't know anymore, but at one time he would do 4 hours of meditation every morning. And this is somebody who has had great awakening experience, et cetera, et cetera. But he does, it would be naive to think he doesn't have pain in his legs, right? But let me assure you that on the other side of this process is something quite wonderful, even though it's challenging. And by the way, you know, when people have, there's a statue of the Buddha in the dining hall. You know, the Buddha did a lot of meditation too. It's naive to think he didn't have pain in his legs. You know, it's like, what, you know, when it was, if you saw the movie Little Buddha and you saw Keanu Reeves as the Buddha, you know, he doesn't look like he's in pain, you know. But even the Buddha had pain in his legs, you know. The Dalai Lama had pain in his legs, you know. Part of a process of transformation. And because, you know, if we just came in, if we got up at 7 and we all assembled here at 8 and we were in a circle and we talked, you know, good things could happen. I agree. But, you know, there'd be limits to the transformation that could happen under those circumstances. You know, ideas are only, you know, they only go skin deep, right? Ideas are only skin deep. You know, I can remember having a conversation with, in college, my roommate was a guy named Larry Sullivan. We shared the same dorm room and we became really fast friends. We're still friends. I was on the same dorm room as all, our dorm was filled with people with S's. So I was Spellmeyer, he was Sullivan. And we were in the same room. And we, after we left our dormitory, we had a house with a couple other guys that we rented back in the days when it was possible for college students to rent a house. Things were much cheaper. But we had been reading, we were taking a philosophy course on nonviolence, and we were talking about nonviolence and reverence for life, this idea of reverence for life. And then a mosquito flew, I can't remember, but you know, Larry just smacked it, right? You know? Or maybe I did. You know, maybe I'm covering in my memory, I've made him the bad guy, right? But it might have been me. You know, mosquito came in, we were talking about reverence for life, and then, bam, you know? Those ideas are really skin deep, right? Really skin deep. It's very difficult not to swat a mosquito that's biting you, right? You have to go into deep samadhi. You know, there's Shoyin Shaku, who I've been talking about occasionally, left Japan and he went to India, something nobody in Japan had done for centuries. And he was a Zen abbot, and he took time off and went to Japan. And he took a riverboat somewhere in India, and he said he did zazen on the deck, and he said as he was doing his zazen, of course, mosquitoes started biting him. And he said, I wanted to do zazen all night, and he said, in the morning when I got up, there were mosquitoes that looked like little cherries. Yeah. And I think he's telling the truth, right, you know? In other words, you know, it takes a very different kind of consciousness not to swat that mosquito, especially when it's biting you. But this is a process of radical transformation, and it wouldn't be radical if it didn't involve our bodies as well as our minds. And by the way, pain is crude and brutal, right? But dealing with pain is so important. I mean, if you run from pain, you'll run from everything, right? There's nothing in life that is worth having that isn't painful. That's not pessimism, it's just a fact. You know, if you want to write a book, man, that is painful, right? I mean, in so many different ways, you know, you have to go in your room and sit there by yourself and write and write. And people go, hey, do you want to go kayaking this weekend? I'd love to, but no, I have to write, you know, and you sit there you spend three of your precious weekends writing a chapter, and then you look at it later and think, this is junk. You throw in the trash. It's like, that is pain, right? Even being in love is painful. That's just a fact, you know? If you're in a relationship with somebody, it's going to hurt sometimes. There's no question about it, right? It's going to hurt. And if you are looking for a relationship that doesn't cause you pain, you're never going to have a relationship. So people who run from pain will run from anything. And pain is like crude and elemental, right? And that's what's so valuable about it. You know, if you don't get... Now, there's degrees of pain. If you have teeth-chattering pain, please adjust your posture. And if you have a physical problem, you have some kind of a physical issue, by all means, you know, please be gentle with yourself. This is Zen is not about punishing yourself or causing yourself to suffer unnecessarily. So I'm just speaking about normal, everyday, household pain in your legs, right? You know, if you're, you know, if you have a sort of a normal health profile and you have pain in your legs, you breathe through the pain in your legs. And if it comes back, you breathe through the pain in your legs, right? And this is incredibly important. You know, if you run from pain, you'll run from everything. So everything is going to take some pain. And so you just keep sweeping the pain away and you enter deep samadhi. And you will, sooner or later, you will have a sit where you think, that's it, pain is in the past, you know, and the next sit it'll be back. But you just keep doing this and, you know, as you are transformed, it's not the case that you have no pain, but you definitely have much less pain and your relationship to it is very different. So, you know, we're just talking about physical pain, but, you know, the practice of Zen also involves all kinds of mental distress, right? And, you know, actually the road to heaven goes through hell, if I may say so. And I don't think there's any other road to heaven but to go through hell. I don't mean you need to put yourself in hell. I mean that, you know, to a certain degree, everybody is in hell. I mean, think about it, you know. People can't get the medical care they need, right? You know, we can go through all the things that make this world like a hell realm, right? And we all have injuries. We all have things that have happened to us that we are not to blame for. And we carry those injuries around in our minds and in our bodies, right? So, but, you know, the way out of hell is right through hell. You have to confront your obstacles. What choice do you have? Right? You have to work through your obstacles patiently, patiently, one breath at a time, one sit at a time. There is no other way, right? Because your obstacles can't be dissolved unless you confront them. So there's no, I don't see any other way. But, you know, you will confront them if you want to, and you will, they will dissolve if you cultivate the mind of emptiness. You know, we recite the Heart Sutra, that brief sutra, and it says basically, you know, basically the Heart Sutra says, there is nothing that emptiness cannot dissolve. No obstacle, no suffering that emptiness cannot dissolve. So cultivating the mind of empty, that empty mind, watching the breath until the mind goes blank, and staying in that blankness is absolutely essential. And then, you know, if you don't have blankness, if you can't ground yourself in emptiness, then your mental distress will eat you alive. But if you can ground yourself in emptiness, as you encounter your obstacles, you keep going back to that emptiness and they gradually dissolve. But you have to develop your, you know, my teacher Genki Roshi used to call your mu power. And people thought mu power meant calling mu very loudly, right? But mu power means you're able to ground yourself deeply in that emptiness. And then when you confront your obstacles, they gradually melt away and stop producing conditioned responses. So, you know, the fact is that the method of getting liberated is to work with the things that are our bonds, with our bonds, our chains, right? there's no other way to get liberated but to work, sort of gradually, link by link, take our chains apart. And there's all kinds, if I may say so, there's all kinds of snake oil salesmen out there who will tell you it's not necessary to do that, but in my opinion, it is. And, you know, you have to take your chains apart link by link, but you have to, you might as well start, you know. The thing is, actually, eventually, you realize that, you know, you need the chains to become enlightened. It's like sickness and medicine. This koan says, Uman said to his disciples, medicine and sickness cure each other. So the things that are obstacles to your awakening can become the doors to your awakening. So, you know, basically, if you have a lot of physical suffering, believe it or not, you know, that can become a door to your awakening. If you have a lot of mental distress, you know, a lot of neuroses and a lot of trauma in your life, that can become, you know, those are all potentially doors to your awakening. Nobody wants to be in pain. Nobody wants to have a history of psychological distress. But, you know, each of those poisons can be transformed into medicine. And the transformative catalyst is emptiness. So it's imperative that you learn how to ground yourself in emptiness, and you learn how to do that in a simple elementary school way by encountering pain in your legs and using the breath to sweep the pain away, and then finally the mind becomes blank. But eventually you're able to deepen your experience of that emptiness until it becomes like almost all-encompassing. This is your mu power. And your mu power can transform like elixir or like a catalyst. It transforms the poisons into medicines. I promise. Uman said to his disciples, medicine and sickness cure each other. All this earth is your medicine. All your suffering is your medicine. So where do you find yourself? Right here on the cushion. This is how finding yourself. Where do you liberate yourself? Right here. Right here. Secho's verse, all earth is medicine, ancient and modern. People make a great mistake. Shut the gate, but do not build the cart. The universe is the highway. They shut the gate. When the universe is the highway, vast and wide, mistaken, all is mistaken. Though their noses are stuck up to heaven, they will be pierced for a rope. So, that's a pretty, he's saying some people have their noses in the air, but they're going to have a rope put through their noses like bulls being led to slaughter. It's not a very kind image. But what he's saying is that, you know, if you just have your eyes on heaven, you can't get out of hell. The way out of hell is, the way to heaven is through hell. And it doesn't mean through suffering. It means through the transformation of your suffering into liberation through emptiness.